This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Okay, bismillah, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah. We begin by praising Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and asking Allah to send His peace and blessings upon the final prophet, Muhammad ibn Abdullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and all those who follow his way with righteousness until the end of time. So today we will continue, inshallah, with the principles of fiqh, looking at the second and third, the third and fourth, which is ijma and qiyas. Before that, quick recap on basically what are the usulul fiqh, what are the sources of fiqh. So just raise your hands if you haven't been here before. Right. Two. Okay. So over the past 3 weeks, we were discussing the usulul fiqh, the principles or the methodology of fiqh, right? Which basically means, how do ulama derive fiqh rulings? What's their method? What's their system? Right? And we said we will focus primarily on the Hanafi method, because each madhab is a different method of deriving rulings. That's how we ended up with different madhabs. Each scholar had his own approach to it. So, we said, number one, all of the madhahib agree that Quran and Sunnah are the primary sources of fiqh. These are the revelation. Right? So again, I didn't mention this point before. Our sources of fiqh are divided into two parts. The revealed sources and the rational sources. The revealed sources are the Quran and the Sunnah. The Quran is the word of Allah. The Sunnah are the teachings of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which we mentioned last week. Some of those are revelation. Some of those are not, and we discuss how we go about deciding which ones are what. Right? So the Quran and Sunnah are the revealed sources. Now the other sources, which we're going to discuss this week, next week, and the week after, the remaining four sources that we're going to discuss are called rational sources. Now a lot of people don't realize this, but a lot of our fiqh doesn't come directly from Quran and Hadith, it comes from the intellectual efforts of ulama. Right? So these are the rational sources of fiqh. And here you will find differences of opinion amongst the ulama on what are the rational sources and what are the limits of them. The first one, all of the madhahib agree upon it, but they have different understandings of what it is and what's the extent to which we use it. Right? This is called ijma. Ijma means consensus of the scholars. Meaning, when all of the ulama share the same opinion, this now becomes binding on the ummah. And if you know anything about ulama, this is very rare. Right? When all of the ulama share the same opinion, then it's binding. And we'll come to this, we'll discuss this in details today. The other rational source that we're going to discuss today is qiyas. Qiyas means a logical deduction based on principles taken from the Quran and Sunnah. So the ulama have deduced principles from the Quran and Sunnah, and these principles over time became the maxims, the qawaid, which we will inshallah discuss in more details next year. And those are used for making qiyas. So qiyas is essentially the rational aspect of fiqh, where the scholars are using their minds to derive fiqh rulings. And qiyas mainly applies on things which are not mentioned in the Quran and Sunnah. So you're going to find a lot of fiqh does not come from Quran and Sunnah, because for example, the technology we use today did not exist in the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So all of our fatawa regarding technology come from qiyas, right? Because we have to now approach it fresh using principles from the Quran and Sunnah. Now qiyas is agreed upon by all four of the main madhabs as a source of fiqh. There's only one madhab that does not accept it. I mentioned it briefly in the first week. Who can remember? Which madhab does not accept qiyas? It's not one of the main ones. Yeah, Zahiri, the literalists. Right? The literalists, which is the madhab of Ibn Hazm of Spain. So in classical Islamic Spain, there was a fifth madhab called the Zahiris. And they were literalists in their fiqh. So they followed Quran and Sunnah and Ijma. Now, I went through Ibn Hazm's book on this topic. And I read it trying to make sense of his argument. I could not understand his argument. And furthermore, there are many fatwas in his book which seemed to be qiyas. He just didn't call it qiyas. So we can say that the Zahiris make qiyas, they just call it something else. They just don't have the same name for it. Right? The next principle, which we will discuss next week. So this week's topics are Ijma and Qiyas. Right? Now these are called the secondary sources of fiqh. Now we come into the area of differences of opinion. The next one, next week's entire lecture is on Urf or Adat, local culture. So the fiqh maxim agreed upon by the four madhabs is Al-Adat Muhakkama. Local culture is the deciding factor. Meaning whenever there is a clash of cultures, you follow the local culture. Next week we will go into details about that. I want to spend an entire hour on that alone, because I really believe this principle can solve many of our problems in South Africa. Unfortunately, it's not being applied in this country. The ulama in America are applying this principle. Ulama in the UK are applying this principle. All the Muslim countries, they apply this principle. South Africa, for some reason, we feel we have to Indianize South Africa in the name of fiqh, instead of adopting to the local culture. So next week's entire presentation is on Urf. The week after that, we will come to the area where there's more differences of opinion on how it's done. And that is overriding qiyas using the goals of the Sharia. In the Hanafi madhab, we call this istihsan. Right? The Malikis call it istisla or maslaha. And the other names for it in other madhabs. But all of the madhabs have something like this, which we will discuss in the final week, which simply means when the qiyas is causing, when the result of the qiyas or when a alim's opinion is causing difficulty or harm to society, it is permissible to choose a different opinion. That's basically what it means. It's a very complex and disputed area, but we will spend an entire lecture just discussing it and the limits of it and how to go about doing it. Because again, it's a principle that can be easily abused. So, before we get into this week's presentation, again, a quick recap. Quran and Sunnah are called the revealed sources, the primary sources of fiqh. The rest of them are called the secondary sources of fiqh or the rational sources of fiqh. Right? Which means, this is where you now use your mind to derive fiqh. We follow in Quran, you're not using your mind, you're following what Allah said. Following hadith, what the Prophet said. Now when it comes to qiyas and ulf and ihtisan, this is now all the intellectual effort of the ulama. Right? This is now where the rational and the logic of the ulama come into play in deriving our rulings. So to begin, we'll spend the first half of the presentation on ijma and the second half on qiyas. What is ijma? The concept of ijma is derived from many hadiths, the most important one being when the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "My ummah will never unite upon falsehood." Right? This is a hadith. So ijma is in a way following hadith, right? Because the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "My ummah will never unite upon falsehood." So the understanding of the ulama from that hadith is that if the entire ummah all have the same opinion on something, it has to be right. So that became known as the third source of law, which is ijma, or the consensus of the scholars. Right? Now the word consensus, this is an important point, the word consensus has a different definition in Islam than it does in Western academics. In Western academia, consensus means normally the majority view. Right? In Islam, it means no differences of opinion. The word for majority view in Islam is jamhur. It's a different term. Right? Jamhur and ijma are not the same. Jamhur means, for example, if the Malikis, Shafis and Hanbalis are on one side and the Hanafis are on another side, we call it jamhur. We don't call it ijma. For example, what time does Salatul Asr set in? Right? When does the beginning of Asr time? So we'll find that the Imam Abu Hanifa, he put the beginning of Asr time later. And the other imams, including the other Hanafi ulama, like his own students, they put the beginning of Asr time earlier. So we will say there's Abu Hanifa's opinion and there's the Jamhur opinion. But we cannot say there's Ijma. Because Ijma means everybody's on the same side. Right? So understand, when we talk about consensus in Islamic law, we're talking about everybody being on the same side, no differences of opinion, and it gets a bit tricky. We'll look at that a bit later. All the madahib accepted as our source of Islamic law, including the Zahiris. And the Zahiris accepted because of the hadith. Again, the Zahiris take hadith very literally. So when the Prophet ﷺ said, "My ummah will never agree upon falsehood," they take that literally, and so they also accept ijma as a source of Islamic law, not from a rational perspective, but from literally following this hadith. Right? So basically what ijma means is when the ummah has consensus on an issue, it is binding on following that opinion. Any deviation from that opinion now becomes something outside the fold of Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. It becomes something deviant, right? When someone goes against the ijma. But having said that, there's a lot of problems with the concept of ijma. There's a lot of controversy in this area. And we're going to discuss that over the next two slides. So let's talk about that. Number one, there's no ijma on the definition of ijma. That's our first problem. If you ask a Shafi, a Maliki, or a Hanafi, what's ijma, you'll get different answers. If you ask a Salafi and a Diobandi, you'll get two different answers. If you ask any group, you're going to get a different answer. Right? So for example, you have amongst the traditional schools of thought, the ijma of the four imams. Right? But other schools of thought don't accept it as ijma. They say that's four people's opinion. Four people's opinion isn't counted as ijma. Right? The four imams themselves didn't even agree upon what is ijma. So how can you now say that the opinion of those four people is ijma? So, let's start off with what we all agree upon. Every single madhab and every single school of thought within Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah all agree that the first three generations, or rather the first generation of Islam, the Sahaba, if they agreed upon something, it is ijma, it is binding. This is all the madhahib accept this. Shafi, Hanafi, Maliki, Hanbali, Zahiri, Salafi, everybody else, Sufyan al-Thawri, Tabari, everybody accepts this, right? Al-Bukhari, everyone accepts that when the first generation, the Sahaba, all share the same opinion, then it is binding on the Ummah. You cannot go against this. Going against this now goes against Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. It can actually push a person outside Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. Having said that, Imam Ash-Shafi, Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, and in recent times Imam Ash-Shawqani, these ulama, they did not, they doubted the possibility of ijma after the time of the Sahaba. Right? So they said, theoretically, if the ummah had to unite on the issue after the time of the Sahaba, it would be counted as ijma, but realistically it's not going to happen. Right? And honestly, I'm inclined towards this opinion, because we know today how hard it is to get people to unite on anything. Right? In the time of Imam Ash-Shafi, he had reservations about it. Nowadays, I mean, can you imagine something new pops up today and all the ulama end up on the same opinion about it? It's very rare. It's a possible. It's a very theoretical possibility, but it's rare. So now, they ask, can this count as ijma? And Imam Ash-Shawqani, he goes into details and he says, even if we said, for example, that in the 3rd or 4th century there was an ijma on the issue. He says, but how do you know? How do you know? In the 3rd or 4th century there were literally thousands of ulama spread across the world. How do you know there weren't ulama in some village far away who had a different opinion that didn't end up in the books? How do you know there wasn't someone who had a different opinion but he was too scared to say it because he's the only alim in his town with that opinion? Imam Ash-Shawqani mentions all this. He says, because of that, he doesn't accept the idea of ijma happening after the time of the first generation. Right? So, when we talk about ijma, what's agreed upon by all the ulama is the sahaba. Ijma of the sahaba. After that, the Hanafi and Maliki madhab say ijma happens in any generation. The Hanbali and Shafi ulama and the scholars who follow Ash-Shawqani, so that's like the Ahli Hadith movement, they only accept that of the sahaba, the first generation. Another thing, does silence count as ijma? Right? It's called ijma sukuti, ijma of silence. Meaning, if in any point in history, all of the ulama who spoke up said something, and many other ulama kept quiet, does that count as ijma? Right? Now the Hanafis and Malikis will say, yes, it counts as ijma. Imam Ash-Shawqani says, no, they may have been scared to say it. I mean, you know what it's like if only one alim in town holds an opinion and the rest of the alims hold a different opinion. How many of them will actually have the courage to say, what they mean? Right? So Ash-Shawqani said, you can't accept that as ijma. Silence is not ijma. Silence simply means he didn't give an opinion. Right? So, one more controversy. If the four imams agreed upon something, is this ijma? And right till today, you're going to have two schools of thought about this. Example, if a man divorces his wife three times in one sitting, does it count as one divorce or three divorces? The four imams said it counts as three. Right? So, one side you have ulama saying, you can only follow that opinion because there's ijma of the four imams of that opinion. On the other side, you have ulama like Ibn Taymiyyah who said, hold on, those are four people. They could be wrong. Abu Bakr didn't count it as, he counted as one. The time of the Prophet ﷺ, it was counted as one. So why can't we count it as one? Right? Do you see that in our history there are those ulama who felt if the four imams on one side, it is possible for the truth to lie outside of that. Right? So now you have two schools of thought. One school of thought says, if the four imams united on something, it's ijma. Another school of thought says, hold on, there are other mazhabs besides that. It doesn't mean that these four imams, their opinion is now that opinion of the entire ummah. Because there are other ulama, there are other mazhabs, so does that count as ijma or not? That's a controversy. Personally, I do not count it as ijma. Right? As I said, I only accept the ijma of the first generation, the sahaba. After that, it becomes an issue where there's differences between the different ways of thinking and the different mazhabs. I'm in the view that after time the sahaba, ijma has never really happened in this ummah. There's always been differences of opinion, except on those things which the first generation agreed upon. One more problem with ijma. And that problem is nowadays people love to misuse this topic. What do I mean by that? Have you ever gotten into an argument with someone about something, and when you quote to them your opinion, they say, there is ijma that it is haram. There is ijma that you are wrong. Right? This is something that people use as a trump card. You know, they throw it in your face. They don't have any other argument. They say there's ijma. Now, this is a problem because I have found 80% of the time, when people simply say there is ijma on the issue, there is no ijma on the issue. Right? 80% of the time. I'm not talking about the ulama, I'm talking about the average Muslim. Because the average Muslim, for example, if you live in a small town in South Africa, and you only know the opinion of the ulama of that town, as an average person, you're going to assume that that is the ijma of the ummah. Right? If you are someone who traveled to Malaysia, to Turkey, to Indonesia, to Saudi Arabia, to Egypt, you become aware, hold on, there are different opinions. Right? So you are less likely to just say there's ijma. For example, the other day on Twitter, I saw someone posted that there's ijma that it's haram to have your pants below your ankles. Imam Ash-Shafi'i deferred to Imam Abu Hanifa on that issue. So where does this ijma come from? Literally in the second generation and in the first generation, there's difference of opinion. So the problem today is a lot of people, when they don't have a debate on their end, they don't have evidence on their end, or they just want to shut you down, they claim ijma. They claim ijma without there actually being ijma. So my advice to you is, when somebody claims ijma, right, you need to ask them, but why am I finding opinions of other scholars? Because clearly, if there are opinions of other scholars, there is no ijma. And that brings us back to my favorite controversial topic, music. Ever we tell someone there's difference of opinion, many people say, oh, there's no difference of opinion, there's ijma. So Imam Ash-Shawqani, and I love Imam Ash-Shawqani, I love his work, he wrote a beautiful book, right? The translation of the title of the book is Refuting the Claim of Ijma on the Prohibition of Music. And what's beautiful about this book is Ash-Shawqani believes music is haram. This is the beauty of the book. Imam Ash-Shawqani believes that music is haram, but he still wrote this book. And in his conclusion is beautiful. So basically in this book, what Ash-Shawqani does is he shows in every generation, going back to the Sahaba, those who believe music was haram, those who believed it was halal. In every generation, even in the Sahaba, he quotes certain Sahaba as saying it's fine, and certain Sahaba as saying it's haram. And he shows in every single generation how this difference of opinion occurred, and his conclusion is beautiful. In his conclusion, he swears by Allah and says, I believe music is haram. And I've never listened to music in my life. But I have written this book so that people understand there's a difference of opinion and they are tolerant to the other opinion. I mean, how beautiful is that? You know, nowadays, you know, people, when they have an opinion, they want to enforce it upon the people and they want everyone to follow them. But Ash-Shawqani had much more academic honesty. He wants people to know, hold on, this is my opinion, but the other opinion does exist. It has always existed. It may be a minority opinion, but it always existed. And so, this is something we need to revive in our time. Not music. Music doesn't need to be revived in our time, right? But academic honesty. That if someone following a different opinion from you, to tell them that I understand there's a difference of opinion, but this is my opinion. Instead of just claiming ijma. This popped up again recently, right? When the Umar series came out. And people were claiming there's ijma that is haram for someone to act as the Sahaba in a TV show. And I'm like, ijma of who? The Sahaba definitely didn't discuss the issue of acting as Sahaba in a TV show. So ijma of who? So I asked one of these people who was claiming ijma. He said, ijma of the ulama of Saudi Arabia. Yeah, ulama of Saudi Arabia is not ijma, that's one country. I mean, come on. Right? Furthermore, Sheikh Salman Al-Ouda is from Saudi Arabia and he's on the committee that approved the show. As is Dr. Yusuf Al-Qaradawi. He's not from Saudi Arabia, right? But he's also on the committee. So the fact that there are ulama who approved the show means there is no ijma. There's ulama on both sides. There may be a majority and a minority. If you want to be academically honest, you can say the majority opinion is that it's haram. But when you claim ijma, that's being dishonest. Right? So we need to be honest here when there's differences of opinion, not to just claim ijma. And like I said, people do this all the time. And every day when they shut down someone's argument, they just claim ijma. So at the end of the day, there are actually very few issues upon which there is ijma. Most of them are already in the Quran and Hadith. Right? We already can derive them from Quran and Hadith. But let's look at a few examples of things which are not in the Quran and Hadith, but are matters of ijma. And so we have to follow them. Right? Let's look at some examples. Number one, the order of the surahs in the Quran. Everybody knows the order of the surahs in the Quran is not the order it was revealed in, right? Surah Alaq was the first surah to be revealed, it's found in the back. Where do we get the order of the surahs of the Quran from? Well, there is ijma of the Sahaba that this is the order. There is consensus of the Sahaba that this is the order. Not a single Sahaba said, hold on, Surah Fatiha should go in the back. Or hold on, Surah Baqarah should go after Surah Al Imran. No Sahaba said this. When the Sahaba compiled the Quran into a single book in the time of Abu Bakr, everybody agreed it's in the right order. Right? Now there's a difference of opinion of how they arrived at that order. This might go a bit too deep for some people. But anyway, there's two opinions. One opinion is, when Jibra'il used to revise the Quran with the Prophet ﷺ every Ramadan, he would revise it in this order. So this became the order. The other opinion is when the Sahaba gathered to compile it into a single Quran, they discussed amongst themselves and chose this order. Right? Now, I believe the first opinion is stronger, that Jibra'il, when he was reciting with the Prophet ﷺ, this was the order it was done, and there's evidence for that. In the last Ramadan, the Prophet ﷺ recited the entire Quran to Jibra'il twice, with Zayd ibn Sabit listening to it. And Zayd ibn Sabit is the one who compiled the Quran, the first Quran, right? In that same order. Right? So therefore, I believe that opinion is stronger. But either way, we can say for sure, not a single Muslim in the first generation said that the order that we have the Quran in today is wrong. They all agreed upon it. So this now becomes ijma. Number two, adding a second adhan for Jum'ah. This was done in the reign of Uthman radiallahu anhu. Right? Uthman radiallahu anhu said. Right? So, in the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, there was only one adhan for Jum'ah. The Quran and Hadith mention nothing about this issue. In the time of Uthman, they expanded the haram for the first time because the ummah was now getting larger and Medina was getting larger, right? And now they found that people weren't getting enough time after the azan to get to the masjid in time for the khutbah. So they came up with the idea, let's have an extra azan so people can close their shops and get there before the second azan, before the khutbah begins. And all of the sahaba said, that's perfectly fine. So we can say this ijma of the sahaba that it's permissible to have two azans for Jummah, right? Now, whether it's compulsory to have two adhans for Jummah is another story. Right? But it's definitely permissible. Again, the additional words in the Fajr adhan. Right? As-salatu khayru min an-nawm. Salah is better than sleep. Not from the Quran, not from the Hadith. Umar radiallahu anhu is the one who added this to the adhan and all of the Sahaba said it's fine. So if all of the Sahaba said it's fine, ijma. Right? Consensus. No Sahabi said you can't add that, it's bid'ah or something like that. Again, praying Taraweeh in congregation. Every night of Ramadan, we pray Taraweeh in congregation. This was only done by the Prophet ﷺ for about 3 nights in his entire life that we know of from the recordings. As a practice for every night of Ramadan, this started in the time of who? Umar. Right? But did any Sahabi object to it? None of the Sahaba objected, so it's ijma. There's consensus that it's permissible. Right? And finally, I'm bringing this one up even though it's technically in the Quran and Hadith, but nowadays a lot of modernists claim it's difference of opinion. There is no difference of opinion. the hair of a woman is a part of her awrah in front of non-mahram men. There's ijma on this amongst all of the madhahib. It's only modernists and Quranists who deny this, right? And that literally is in the past 50 years, or rather, yeah, the past 50 years, not even before that. Even the modernists before that never denied it, right? If you had to ask the early modernists like Rashad Rida or Muhammad Abdu Deitu, will say woman's hair is awrah, right? So the woman's hair, awra, means she has to cover it in front of non-mahram men. The idea that she doesn't have to do it at all, you dress according to your culture in terms of that, that's a new idea that popped up recently. So I bring it up because again, nowadays people say, no, there's no ijma. There is ijma, there's Quran, there's hadith, and there's ijma on this issue. The strongest evidence being the hadith of Asma, radiallahu anha, where the Prophet ﷺ told her when a woman reaches puberty, nothing should be seen of her besides her face and hands. Right, that's the strongest evidence. So you will not find any madhab saying it's okay for a woman not to cover her hair. That's not part of any madhab. There are other things, they differ over the feet, they differ over the upper arms, they differ over many other things, but not the face, not the hair. The hair is agreed upon. Right? So that's ijma. Is everybody clear on this topic before we move on to qiyas? Yes.
But the surahs of the Quran, was that also ijma?
Yes, there was ijma because when it was done, there were no sahaba who said this is a bad idea or we should not allow to do this. Rather, they all accepted that this is a good thing to do. Right? Had there been some sahaba who said, hold on, the Prophet did not put the Quran into a single volume, so we cannot put it in a single volume, then that becomes a matter of difference of opinion. But the fact that not only they all accepted it, but it became the standardized Quran that we use right until today, meaning there's ijma of every single generation of Islam on it. Right? So, yes, there was. That's also an example of ijma. That is a good example of ijma. So, just to recap, ijma means when the ummah agrees upon something, it's binding to follow, and it becomes deviation to go against it. Having said that, only the Sahaba's time we can really confirm ijma. Because the ummah was smaller, there were less people around. If someone had a difference of opinion, they were more vocal about it. The Sahaba weren't scared to say their opinions, right? And it's all recorded. After that time, it becomes more difficult to really know if ijma existed or not. So these kind of issues where we can go back to the Sahaba and say the Sahaba agreed upon it, these we accept as matters of ijma. Something later it becomes different.
So, you know, as far as ijma is concerned, the Sahaba were all together.
Yes.
In one area.
No. They weren't in one area.
Well, it was more or less a confined geographical area.
You see Arabia?
Yeah Arabia.
Okay. Yes.
And they could communicate with each other.
They could, yes, that's true.
As Islam grew and spread far and wide,
it became less practical and less possible.
Less practical, but today, we have communication media.
That's true.
You know, which is extremely fast. And people can communicate from one part of the world to the other in seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So, maybe the first generation had ijma.
Yeah.
Or practiced ijma.
Yeah.
And they couldn't after that because communication was difficult.
That's true.
Because people lived in all four corners of the world. As Islam spread far and wide, Spain, India, and so on.
Yeah.
And it would take a lot of effort for people to communicate with each other.
Yeah.
Now, these days that we have these
technology,
communication technology, digitalization of hadith, digitalization of the Quran, is it not possible then to have ijma?
It's theoretically possible.
Theoretically
possible, but because we differ on so many issues, I don't know if it's practically possible. I was thinking about it. I came up with one issue where I think there is a modern day ijma on. The prohibition of pornography. I don't think anyone in the alim is going to have a difference of opinion there, right? It's a modern day issue. It's a new issue. But I don't think any alim in the world is going to say it's fine. I don't think. If there is, I'd like to meet him and have a discussion with him and give him a piece of my mind.
The big issue is human trafficking.
Yes.
Similar to slavery, surely
there
should be something like that.
Yes, that's true. We could even say there was when slavery was abolished in the Ummah, it was done through ijma. We can't say that. Because technically our Quran and Hadith allow slavery, but no alim will tell you allowed to take slaves today because there is ijma of the Ummah that in the time and place we are living in, we're not allowed to do that based on international laws and the world we're living in today. So you can even give that as a modern example of ijma. The fact that the entire Ummah agreed to just get rid of this entire concept, which was part of our religion for over 1,000 years. So that's, you're right, it is possible. Very rare, but it's possible. So I'm not saying there is no ijma, but I say it's theoretically possible, and maybe occasionally we may come across the issue where there is ijma in our times. So it's a good point you raise. And that's always been ijma. They do. Okay. I did not know about that. So maybe there is no ijma there. Okay. Let's move on. We don't have enough time.
Jamiat.
The elders say again doesn't. I don't think technically even a quran diet would show its ijma. I think it's just a way of. It's just an emotional issue. You know? You can't go against your elders.
What about women in the
mosque? What about it? There's never been ijma. In fact, we can say that in early Islam there was basically consensus that women were allowed in the mosque. No, that didn't happen. That's a complete misunderstanding of what he said. Women have been going to the masjid or in Medina from the time of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam right until today. Today we have the most hardcore conservative people ruling Medina, and they still don't stop women from going to the masjid. It never happened. I don't know of any point in history where women did not go to the Prophet's masjid. Those who say Umar stopped it, they are misunderstanding the hadith. The Umar stopped women from entering the masjid inappropriately dressed. Those who were dressed appropriately did not stop them. Right? So that's a misunderstanding of that narration. Right? And we know it's true because when Uthman was the Khalifa, which is after Umar's time, and when he was attacked in the masjid, didn't some of the women stand up to defend him?
Yeah.
Wasn't Umar himself corrected in the masjid by a woman?
What he's saying is that the local ulama
claim ijma.
Claim ijma on the fact that women should not be going to the mosque.
But if they call it ijma, why is the rest of the Muslim world not agreeing with him?
No, they're using ijma of their.
That's not ijma.
Exactly,
so that's not ijma. That is not ijma. Ijma, and again, this is the problem. I wanted to mention this. A lot of schools of thought regard their ulama only as ijma. And that is a major problem in our times.
When you confront them on the issue, they said they will not have mosques. Makkah and Medina that allow women to the rest of the mosque to Aqsa.
Mm-hmm.
That these are haram, and that's why.
Yes. Any other way, almost any Muslim country go to women pray Salah in the masjid. Majority of Muslim countries and non-Muslim countries.
Even
from the people from the same school of thought, the ones in other countries are more or less conservative on this issue. Okay, we are really running out of time and we have to do qiyas still. When we have to do qiyas, we have to study qiyas. We'll do qiyas on this topic later, inshallah. Well, let's get back to our topic here. Qiyas. Qiyas is one of the most important things for our time. And I'm going to give examples of that, right? Because again, for those people who think the doors of ijtihad closed, how then do you solve problems of the modern world? You need qiyas. You need qiyas to solve modern issues. It's ridiculous to say there's no ijtihad today, because you got the examples I'm going to look at were not discussed by the Sahaba or Imam Abu Hanifa or Imam Malik. They are literally new things that require new rulings, right? And these are matters of qiyas. So qiyas means a scholar does a logical deduction, not based on his own ideas, not based on some man-made ideology, based on principles extracted from the Quran and Sunnah. Right? And the qiyas was practiced by the Sahaba during the life of the Prophet ﷺ. During the Prophet's life, Sahaba practiced qiyas and the Prophet ﷺ approved of it. There's even narrations where he asked the Sahabi who was moving to another land, what would you do if someone asked you a question? And the Sahabi said, I will check in the Quran. He said, what if it's not in the Quran? He said, I will remember what you taught me. He said, what if I didn't teach you anything about it? And then he said, I will use my mind to work it out. And the Prophet said, that's the right way. And he approved of qiyas. Verbally and in terms of how he dealt with Abu Bakr and Umar and many others. He let them make qiyas in his presence and then told them whether they're right or wrong. So qiyas has always been there in the Ummah. All of the madahib besides the Zahiris, and I accept it as a source of fiqh. And I said the Zahiris, they say it's not a source of fiqh, but when you read their books, it's clearly there and without using the actual word. It's clearly there. Right? And I read through Ibn Hazm's entire Al-Muhalla, and I found many, many examples of qiyas, even though he didn't call it qiyas. Right? The result of qiyas and are speculative. Now this is important. Qiyas is a secondary rational source of fiqh. This is where most of our differences of opinion come from. And it's important to understand that qiyas is speculative. The word in Arabic is dhanni. Meaning, when a scholar arrives at a conclusion through qiyas, He needs to say, this is my opinion and Allah knows best. He cannot claim that the entire ummah must now follow his opinion. He has no right to do that. Because this is a dhanni issue, it's speculative. Right? When it comes to the areas of differences of opinion between ulama, majority of it is matters of qiyas. Because you have to understand, when ulama make qiyas, their qiyas is going to take them in different directions. One's going to look at this from one way, some's going to look at it from another way, some's going to combine those two ways, someone's going to come from a completely different direction. Qiyas is where most of our differences of opinion come from. Now, qiyas is very important. And in later generations, the ulama invented easier ways to make qiyas. In the early generations, it wasn't standardized. Right? Each alim basically had his own method of qiyas. Later generations, they invented a new science in fiqh that made qiyas very easy, called the qawaid al-fiqhiyah, the maxims of fiqh. And inshallah, next year, we will do 6 weeks just on the maxims of fiqh. Right? We'll go into details about this. Six lessons entirely on the maxims of fiqh. But very briefly, maxims are short statements that the ulama memorize that are used in qiyas. Right, they are short principles that are used in qiyas. So what I'm going to do today for y'all in the remainder of the session is I'm going to take about 4 or 5 maxims and I'm going to give an example of each one for modern fiqh. Right? So, I'm going to show how we use these maxims to arrive at rulings for new issues. And that shows you the importance of these maxims. So before I do that, does everybody understand what a fiqh maxim is? Any, raise your hands if you don't understand that point. Right. A fiqh maxim basically means a short sentence that an alim memorizes that becomes a principle of fiqh. Maybe if I give an example, you understand. First example, al-aslu fil ashyahi al-ibaha. This is a maxim of fiqh in all four madhabs. The original state of things is permissibility. All of the madhahib today agree upon this. Which means, when someone asks you, is this halal or haram? The original ruling for anything is halal. Right? So this is a maxim of fiqh. So when ulama make qiyas, they start from here. They don't start from haram. They start from halal. They only go to haram when there is a genuine reason. What would be a genuine reason? Maxim number 2. Ad-daru yuzal. Harm must be eliminated. If something is harmful to society, if something is harmful to the individual, if the harms outweigh the benefits, then we say this is haram. Right? So, these are maxims of fiqh. So, when a scholar is making qiyas, someone walks up to a scholar, something new has been invented, someone invents a new technology, they ask the sheikh, is this halal or haram? He will use these maxims. He'll say, okay, original state, permissibility. If it's harmful, it becomes haram. Let's see if this thing's harmful or not. Right? And then he'll use this to do his qiyas. Another example of a maxim, right? That necessity makes the haram halal. Where do we get this maxim from? Quran. The verse of fasting, if you are traveling or you are sick, make it up later. Right? The narration of Ammar ibn Yasir, when Abu Jahl told him to say words of kufr to save his life. Right? He said, if you say these words of kufr, I won't kill you. And he said it. And the Prophet said, it's fine for you to say it as long as you don't believe it. That gives us this idea that necessity makes the haram halal. Right? And by the way, necessity here doesn't only include life and death situations. There's different levels of necessity that make different types of things halal. Right? Regulating that. So now we have maxims regulating maxims. A maxim that regulates that is, if something is permissible due to an excuse, right? This is invalidated if it goes away. Meaning what? Means, for example, if you had a injured back, so you started to sit and pray. It becomes permissible for you to sit and pray. Once your back is healed and you can pray normally, is it still permissible for you to sit and pray? Why? The excuse is gone, so now the rule changes. Right? Understand? I'm going to use all of these in modern issues in the next slide. Finally, anything that is needed to fulfill an obligation becomes an obligation. Right? Is it wajib to make wudu? Not normally. But if it's salah time and you don't have wudu, it becomes wajib. Why? To fulfill the obligation of salah, you need wudu. Therefore, wudu at that time becomes an obligation. Right? So this is where we derive the maxim from. Now let's take each of these 5 and apply them to a modern issue. Right? To show you exactly how ulama make qiyas. And again, ulama are going to end up with different opinions. These are my opinions based on these maxims. Right? So, the first maxim, the original state of things is permissibility. So therefore, whenever a new technology is invented, we will say it's halal. In general. Right? In general, all new technology is halal to use unless it contradicts one of the maxims that make things haram. Right? So in general, the invention of new technology and the usage of new technology is permissible. Right? We're not a religion that says we need to be walking around riding horses and, you know, basically living like we in the olden days. Technology is in of itself permissible. That's an easy one. Number two, what did I say with the second maxim? Harm must be eliminated. Modern fatwa we derive from that. Smoking cigarettes, or using recreational drugs, right? All of this is prohibited. Why? It's harmful to your health. It's harmful to your health and to those around you as well. But even if it wasn't to those around you, it's harmful to your health. It causes cancer. In the case of recreational drugs, some of them cause much worse things than that. Right? In general, you are not allowed to harm your own body and health without an actual genuine reason to do so. What do I mean by a genuine reason to do so? I mean, obviously, if you're going for an operation, there is some physical harm, someone's cutting your body open, but there's a genuine reason to do so. Right? They're saving you from something else. Someone's smoking a cigarette, what exactly is the Sharia benefit they're getting from that? You see, when you make qiyas, we cover this in the Maqasidah, when you study Maqasidah Sharia, when you make qiyas, we weigh things on a scale of benefits and harms. If the harms outweigh the benefits, it's haram. So my argument to people who say that smoking cigarettes is permissible is, what are the Sharia benefits of smoking that outweigh the harms of causing cancer? If you can prove to me there are Sharia benefits of smoking that outweigh the harms of causing cancer, then maybe I'll change my opinion on this. But until you can do so, I'm of the opinion it's haram. It is haram to harm your own health. Right? What was the next maxim?
Necessity
makes the haram halal. Right, time for controversial fatwa number one. I believe health insurance is halal in this time, in this age, in this country. Right? Because of necessity. Right? Why? Because of necessity. Now, again, qiyas takes people in different directions. There are some ulama who say it's halal in of itself. In of itself. There are ulama like in Malaysia and stuff who say it's halal in of itself. That their qiyas led them to the direction that insurance is fine. My qiyas leads me to the direction that in of itself, insurance contains elements of interest and elements of gambling. Therefore, in of itself, it would not be permissible in a society where there are alternatives. Now, if you are living in a society where there's no alternatives, what do you do? Do you end up in debt? Do you end up just leaving someone to die because they can't afford to go to the hospital? What do you do in those situations? Right? So in my opinion, if you are living in a country where there is no halal alternative, there's no free Medicare that's good. Again, people say, but there are free hospitals, but we know the quality of free hospitals, right, in this country. So, again, this fatwa, firstly, this opinion will change from country to country. Please keep that in mind. My opinion on this will change from country to country. And that's another thing to keep in mind. Fiqh changes from country to country, culture to culture, society to society. But my opinion is, if someone's living in a country where not allowing Muslims to have health insurance is going to cause unreasonable harm to people. What do you mean by unreasonable harm to people? Someone's child meets in an accident, he ends up in hospital, they get a 250,000 rand bill. They spend the rest of their life paying off that bill plus interest. It would have been easier for them to have paid health insurance. It would have made life easier for them. So that we can say is a necessity that makes something halal. Right, so that's why I come to the opinion it's fine in these countries to have car insurance, health insurance, most of these type of insurance, simply because without them we are making life unnecessarily difficult for the Muslims. And let's face it, the ulama who say it's haram, at the end of the day, many of them have to take it themselves. Right? Many of them end up having to take insurance themselves because it becomes impossible sometimes to live without it.
Including life insurance?
Life insurance, no. Generally, no, because again, there's really no Sharia necessity there. There's no real necessity there.
Some of the ulama recently, I read somewhere, if you take life insurance to cover your house,
because
if you pass away,
and
the house is not
lost,
your family
is going
to lose the shelter.
Okay, so again, it will depend from place to place and circumstance. The general I would say no. And again, I would have to research the issue more. And what, again, I don't normally just give opinions on the spot. So to that question, my answer now is no, but let me read 1,000 research papers on it and get back to you. Okay? I don't want to just give a patwa without doing my research properly.
I think the general opinion of Ulama here is that all insurance possible except life insurance.
Except life insurance. Except, yeah. I also have a similar opinion.
The latest one I've read now, I can't remember where, that if it's to secure your bond, you've got a bond in a house, the bank will insist that you have a life policy.
And again, these things will change from person to person and case to case. So again, many a times when people ask you, remember, especially maxims like this, maxims like necessity makes the haram halal, very often it's a person to person thing. Because what's necessity for one person may not be necessity for somebody else. Right? So we don't just give out general, and this is why, again, I'm completely against the idea of general fatawa. It must be done on a person-to-person basis, right? Now, before I take any more questions, let's finish our slides. Otherwise, we're going to spend the whole day debating insurance. The next point, I keep in mind maxims 2, 3, and 4 that I taught you. So, maxim 2 was that we must eliminate harm. Maxim 3 was necessity makes a haram halal. And maxim 4 is when that necessity is lifted, it goes back to haram. Now, I spend a lot of time thinking about this issue. I actually haven't really read anything official on it, but this is my own opinion. The issue of medication like addictive painkillers, which we know nowadays there's a huge epidemic of people being addicted to it, their lives being ruined by it, people overdosing on it, people just going off the path because of the addiction to it. Where do we put this in the realm of fatawa? So this is my opinion on addictive painkillers. It's only allowed at the time of need according to the doctor's prescription. Nothing more than that. Meaning, my opinion is, harm must be eliminated. Addictive painkillers, when they are misused, when they are abused, when they are used outside of a prescription, it is extremely harmful. Right? So therefore, in of itself, it would not be permissible for someone to just buy it and use it. Right? However, if the doctor says, listen, you need this twice a day for 6 months, then for that person, twice a day for 6 months, it becomes permissible. Once that's over and the doctor says, don't take this anymore, it's no more permissible for that person to take it. Right? Now again, this fatwa is something from my side. I don't know anybody else who says it. I don't know anybody else who even talks about this topic. But reality is, amongst the Muslim community, we have a lot of people who are addicted to these things. How do we prevent it? I believe this fatwa can serve as a prevention to that. Right? That if people know and they believe and they understand that you don't take this thing unless there's necessity, then maybe we can prevent this from happening. Allah knows best. I don't know, the doctors in the house, what do you all think about that? You agree?
I know the timing and the program on the radio.
Yeah.
Coincidentally,
yeah. So it's a major issue. This is where my chaos went from.
Exactly what you said, that you only use painkillers when required. If you use it beyond the time that you require, it actually causes more harm.
It does cause more harm. It becomes no different from a recreational drug at some point. Yeah. So I believe we need to promote this idea amongst Muslims, you don't use these things. Right? Unless necessary. In fact, I myself, I don't use any medication in my life unless it's necessity. I just don't. Yeah. We need to have a whole session on that thing. Okay, now the last fatwa. Guy comes to you and he's like, I don't want to work, right? So, is it wajib for a man to work? Is it compulsory for a man to work? No. Yes or no?
Yes.
It's compulsory for a man to provide for his family. Okay. What if someone's a multimillionaire? Is it wajib for him to work? Does he have to go to work? Is it a sin for him to sit at home and play video games or watch Netflix? Technically, no. Because what's wajib on him is to provide for his family. Now, if a man is unable to do that, what was the last maxim we said? Whatever is needed to fulfill a wajib becomes wajib. So this guy is sitting at home playing video games. His wife and kids are hungry. He doesn't want to get a job. We will tell him it is wajib for you to work because it's wajib for you to provide for your family. And whatever is required to fulfill a wajib becomes wajib. Right? Whatever is required to fulfill an obligation becomes an obligation. Again, case by case, person by person. If someone is well off, it is not wajib on him to work. He can provide for his family for the rest of his life, and even after he is dead, and even his great-grandchildren and his great-great-grandchildren while ever working a day of his life. Right? But for the average person, to fulfill these obligations, you've got to work. Right? So this is something that only becomes wajib when a person is unable to provide for their family in other ways. So again, these are examples of how qiyas is done. And I hope it gives you an idea of why this is so important. Why it's so important that every community, in every era, has ulama amongst them who can make qiyas. Because otherwise, how then do we derive conclusion? I mean, people say the doors of ijtihad are closed. I say, then what do we say about these issues? The four imams never discussed insurance. They never discussed painkillers. Right? They never discussed technologies. Right? It didn't exist in their time. You have to make ijtihad on these issues. There's no other way as a ummah to deal with these issues unless we make ijtihad. So, and that's why I say even the people who say that the doors of ijtihad are closed, they end up making ijtihad anyway. Because there is no other way to deal with these issues. So to conclude, we said that the ijma, the consensus of the sahaba, is a binding proof on the ummah. And after the time of the sahaba, it becomes contentious. Is it possible or not? We gave a few examples where it is possible, but it's very rare. Very rare. Right? Qiyas. Qiyas is necessary. It's necessary for the ulama to use qiyas to derive practical fatawa. Now next week and the week after, we look at some of the other principles that can override qiyas. Right? Like istihsan and urf. There are times when they can override qiyas. Right? We will look at that in details over the next 2 weeks. But in general, qiyas is very important. And the maxims were constructed to make qiyas easier. So in the early generations, the ulama had to really just... There were no books on the topic. They were literally writing the books on the topic. They had to just each one make qiyas on their own. But as the years went by and as our scholarship developed, it became so much easier once the ulama invented al-qawaid al-fiqhiyah, the fixed maxims, because now you just memorize these 40 or 50 statements and you use them to make qiyas. Right? And inshallah, we'll discuss that sometime next year. Next week's topic is, anyone remembers? Urf, local culture. Right? Our fiqh must be localized. And it's something I say a lot, and it's something I get in trouble for saying a lot, but I truly, truly believe it. Our fiqh must be localized. We have to localize our fiqh. Everybody else has done it. Malaysia's fiqh is different from Egypt's fiqh. Fiqh in Egypt is different from fiqh in Turkey. Fiqh in Turkey is different from fiqh in the United Kingdom. Same with the USA, right? Same with the Saudi Arabia. Every country has a fiqh that is based on their local culture. It's only in South Africa that we have barriers to doing this. So we have to discuss it. I'm going to look at examples of specific areas of fiqh where we have to do this. And we're going to discuss how it's done. What are the limits to it? There are limits to urf as well. Because the modernists, they go overboard when it comes to urf. They just take this and they override Quran, override Hadith, override Ijma. Now, urf becomes a Sharia to them. That's the other extreme. Right? So we'll discuss all of that next week. We'll look at what is urf, what are its limits, what are its needs, what are the areas we can use it in today, and some of my conclusions based on it. With that, we come to the end of this week's discussion. We have time for Q&A. You have any questions, raise your hands now. I'm just putting it back on the maxims page because I have a feeling most of the questions will be related to these. Okay, in the back. Sure.
About women going to the graveyards.
Yes.
And specifically for Hanafis.
Yeah.
But there was something mentioned in passing, maybe I thought you can expand in today's time, the consensus, we know Shafi women,
yeah.
In terms of worldwide practice of Hanafis, we know South African Hanafis. Mm.
Hanafi ulama I've met in the USA and the UK, they all allow it. The Hanafi ulama I've met from other countries allow it. It's really just the subcontinent in South Africa, I think, where they still regard it as not allowed. I'm not sure about Turkey. In Turkey, do women go to the graveyard? They do? Okay. So in Turkey, it's also... So that's also Hanafi, and then they allow it. Either way...
They discuss it
in all areas.
No, I know, but I do sometimes see women
Yeah, but those are going against the fatwa. They're not going there because of a fatwa.
But there are two issues, visiting and going for
Okay.
Going for the actual
so, in general, I mean, how many of you have been for Umrah? Women, they generally attend the Janazah Salah, right? Generally, when you go into the graveyard itself for the actual burial, I personally don't see a problem with it unless, right, this is the condition many of the classical ulama have put. But it doesn't really apply in our time because this is an old practice that I don't think anyone does nowadays. Right? And that is, the thing that was prohibited was actually mourning. I don't know if you know, in classical Arab culture at the time of the Prophet ﷺ, they used to have these women who used to go to the graveyard and their job was to scream and to wail and to say things like, how are we going to live without you? And to just go crazy. They literally used to hire women to do these things. And so some of the ulama say that's what's prohibited. They don't do that. Now if a woman is just going and she's standing quietly and she's making dua and she's fulfilling the Sharia obligations, like, you know, then it doesn't apply to her. And the thing is, in our times, nobody does that anymore. I don't think in any culture today we still have this mourning practice where women go and scream at the graveyards and tear their clothes and
they do that at home.
They do that at home. Okay.
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah.
They're not allowed still.
No.
Again, it's the opinion of the ulama of the time.
I think it's a recent thing. I think it's recent.
But are they recently Saudi moving the opposite direction?
Yeah.
That's a very confusing country. Just in general, don't take your fig based on what people are doing in Saudi Arabia, because one day all the ulama is saying woman driving is haram, the next day all the same ulama are saying it's fine. Right, just based on whatever the government wants. So don't make that your source of fig.
Based on
what America wants.
Now, one thing that's bothering me, you know, in the context of this course that we're doing,
yeah,
there are burning issues, especially in this country, the question of haram and halal as far as food is concerned. Halal and haram as far as food
is concerned. Okay.
You know, there's all these different halal bodies and so on, these different criteria. And I think there's a lot of confusion there. I think you need to check that up for us. I'm proposing that we actually have one or two sessions on
fig or food.
You
can consider for next year. We'll do.
I think it's extremely important. We should actually widely advertise this, because I think it's a minefield. And I, as you know, from my limited understanding, there's a lot of confusion out there. People don't know what they're talking about, and many of the halal bodies also really do not apply the criteria correctly.
Yeah.
You know, the first thing is haram. That's the maximum. You know, the reason the maximum.
Well, actually, no. But actually,
you usually start with haram first. Even if it comes.
Let me correct you on this. There is a maximum in fiqh when it comes to meat. The original state is haram, unless it can be proven.
Meat now.
Yeah. Other type of thing. Okay. Yeah. No, so now that area, I agree with you there. But so people know. Just so people know, when I say the original state of things is permissibility, there is another maxim that says when it comes to meat, the original state of meat is haram unless it can be proven to be halal.
Right?
Okay, that's very important. It is true. So inshallah, maybe we'll plan that. The problem with that is there are so many differences of opinion in there.
That's what we need to know about.
Understand all the different opinions on that.
I think that, is the ijma
on any point?
No. On the five maxims.
The five main maxims. Okay, good.
Is there consent ijma on that through scholarship?
Yes. All four madhabs agree on that. And even this.
I'm reading it slightly differently from.
Okay, what he says?
Maybe I'll read it out to you, the five that he gives, right?
Yeah. These are not the five. These are just some examples I gave for what. This is not the five. Not the big five. No, the big five we do next year.
Okay.
But just to clear that, okay, lucky you mentioned that.
Matters will be judged by their purposes. Mm-hmm. That's the first maxim. Matters will be judged by the first. That's my answer, right? The second one is.
Okay, I'll do it for you. The first one is al-yaqeenu. The first one is that the matters are judged by nature. Number two is. Al-yaqeenu la yazulu bishak. Conviction cannot be overruled by doubt. Number three is ad-daru yuzal. Harm must be eliminated. Number four is al-mashakkatu tajribu taysir. Necessity makes the haram halal. Number five is al-adad muhakkamat. that local culture is the deciding factor. Don't worry, but I'm going to teach this in university. I memorized it.
I just
talked
to this
So what Brother Muhammad is talking about are called the Big Five. The Big Five. These are the big, not our South African animals, the maxims of fiqh. So basically, all four madhabs and even the Salafis and every other school of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah all agree upon five maxims of fiqh. And those five are, number one, actions are judged by their intentions. All the madhabs agree. Right? Your actions are judged by your intentions. Now, how they apply it differs. Number two, conviction cannot be overruled by doubt. What does this mean? You remember making wudu. You can't remember whether you broke your wudu or not. It's considered that you still have wudu. Because you're convinced that you made wudu, you're doubtful about the other thing. You go with what you are convinced about. And again, there's a whole... In fact, the original state of things being permissibility is a sub-maxim of that. You're convinced that things are originally halal. You doubt about whether this is haram or not. It stays halal until proven otherwise. The third one, harm must be eliminated. All the madahib agree on that. All of the madahib, in fact, that's from the maqasid, from the goals of the sharia. The second goal of the sharia is the elimination of harm. The first one is the attainment of benefit. The fourth maxim is al-mashakkatu tajribu taysir, which means difficulty causes the law to relax. Difficulty causes the law to relax. Meaning, for example, you can't stand and pray, you sit and pray. Right? You can't make wudu, you make tayammum. Right? You're traveling, you shorten your salah. None of these are life and death situations. It's simply difficulty. Difficulty makes the law easier. All the madhabs agree upon this. And finally, all the madhabs agree on al-adat muhakkama, local culture is the deciding factor. All the madhabs agree on this. And in fact, the Hanafi madhab specifically emphasizes this. Urf plays a bigger role in the Hanafi madhab than any other madhab. That you follow the local culture, not foreign cultures. And that's why I'm so confused as how the Hanafi madhab is practiced in this country. Really, because that's really one of the most important parts of Hanafi fiqh. You adapt to the local culture. And honestly, I think this is one of the biggest barriers to da'wah in our country. Really, that we're trying to enforce our Indianized Islam upon every other culture. Except just letting people be. Let people convert to Islam and just stick with their cultures. Why do you have to try and get them to eat biryani and wear kurtas and say jiapa and Let them stick with their cultures. So we'll discuss that in next week. But yeah, what Brother Muhammad mentioned, those are called the Big Five. Right? Al-Qawaid al-Fiqhiyya al-Kubra. The five major maxims. And those five, all the mazhabs agree upon them. And really they say, most of fiqh can be derived from those five. Most of fiqh can be derived from those five maxims. As I say, I teach Al-Qawaid at the online university, so it's one of my favorite subjects. It's absolutely beautiful to study. Inshallah, next year we'll go into that in more details. What I mentioned here is simply five examples of maxims, not the Big Five. Not to be confused with that. Okay. Any more questions?
How do Dawud Ulooms teach this? Because
they clear, don't.
Clear.
Oh, here's the thing. I graduated from the Darul Uloom in 2006. I only heard about the Qawaid in 2011 or 12. Same with the Maqasid. I was literally an alim for 5 years before I even heard about these concepts.
They don't teach this?
They don't. They don't even know it. It doesn't exist in the curriculum. I literally never heard these terms until 5 years after I graduated. Until I got hold of Ibn Ashur's book and Shah Waliullah's books. And then I'm like, what is this? This is fake. This is beautiful. Why didn't we learn this before? So that's a major problem. So for example, in other countries they do teach it. I think it's taught in Malaysia, it's taught in Saudi Arabia, it's taught in Egypt, it's taught in the online universities. Our South African Darun don't teach it at all. They don't even mention these words. Because remember, they believe the doors of HDR are closed. So there's no need for Qawaid, no need for Maqasid, none of this. No need for it at all. So really, if you mention Qawaid with Fiqhiyya, I guarantee you a lot of ulama never even heard of the term.
But
well,
they said they haven't heard of
Maqasid. Huh? Yeah. They've never heard of Maqasid. Never, never.
Maqasid in the rules. Unless I got it from them directly.
Yeah. They don't teach it. And the thing is, for example, one of the greatest books of Maqasid al-Sharia is the Hujjatullah Baligha by Shah Waliullah. And he was one of the greatest Hanafi ulama. Right? And he discusses, that book is just so brilliant. He discusses the Maqasid, the Qawaid, the importance of reviving Ijtihad. If we just could teach that book in our Darul Ulooms, we would produce a whole different caliber of ulama. Just that one book alone. It's absolutely mind-blowing. So, yeah, that is a major, major problem we have in this community. That we don't even know this subject exists.
I just mentioned one question. what's going on in Darul Uloom? I just saw today a late graduation in the class. Out of 22 students who are graduating Alims, three South Africans.
Three
out of 22.
Okay.
And four are coming out with as what do you call Sharia. Four students are graduating and as Muftis,
okay.
Not a single son. Understanding what's going on in that room.
Okay.
That's
so where are our Muftis coming from then? Do we have a new generation of Muftis?
Not one graduating this week.
Okay, so just in the past 5 years, have there actually been any local Mufti graduates, new Muftis popping up in the block?
But if you look at, I'm going to use the vaccines as an example. Mm-hmm. We are seeing the effects on, I'm going to say more than any of us, we all see that because of the resistance of certain allergies to vaccines, for example,
mm-hmm.
and those who follow them not taking, we are literally seeing people having to go to ICU
mm-hmm.
and the effects on all of the other children
mm-hmm.
coming on in America because of this resistance to vaccines. First, it was based on pork and whatever, I mean, you give the example of health insurance.
Yeah.
0.00. And now you don't even need both in those vaccines, you don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet.
But what is the basis for the fatwa? That you don't know what's in it? Or what's the basis?
The one part is the conspiracy theory that the Rothschilds.
Okay, yeah, conspiracy. You do not ever base fatwa on conspiracy theory. That's pick 101.
There is one. Yeah. The other strong one is. And it has traces of fog.
Okay.
Right? And that has been, and we are seeing hundreds of children getting sick because of that.
The fog one is a little bit more complicated. Now, this we need to discuss. Again, this needs to be discussed. Yeah, but really, you need to actually have ulama sit down with doctors and discuss. Because I'll tell you honestly, when I graduated, I was of that view as well because that's what my teachers taught me. And I held that view for 10 years after I graduated. Until I actually sat down with doctors and they explained to me how the whole thing works. Like, whoa, I made a major mistake here. Mm-hmm. Right? And then only I changed my view. So doctors have to sit down with the guys. Because honestly, what we were taught this whole conspiracy theory as facts. And we were taught that, you know, it's haram. And that, you know, there's doubt. You cannot use it because it's out. And we were taught all these things about the pork and... People, the ulama who are taught that, no one's teaching them the other side of the story. So I think we have to have an honest, mature discussion where our you know, what's our medical body called here? Yeah, they need to sit down with the ulama and have an honest discussion. And what happens?
The majority of the ulama bodies in DC, the United Ulama Council, have endorsed human vaccines.
They have.
There's only two bodies that haven't endorsed. There's the
Majlis. Majlis doesn't count. Yeah.
That's
becoming an issue for
I think what the problem is regarding this. I know one Muslim in a parent school where some of these kids are not vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know the teachers of the school, and I said, how can you allow this to enforce me?
Mm-hmm.
Governing body insists that he must be allowed. They're not vaccinated.
Yeah, I wrote a letter to the governing body of one of the school jobs demanding that they don't admit children they are not vaccinated.
Okay.
They're a risk for other children.
Correct.
Mm.
One, two is, I mean, this is a practical example. In the last week, I've had to discuss this whole issue with three of my patients who basically didn't want to vaccinate the children. I had to spend a lot of time trying to debrief it because it's brainwashed.
Well, the one good point that you mentioned to me was that the majority of ulama have changed their view. So there's hope there. And there's hope within the next 5 or 10 years the others will get on board with them as well. Maybe the others will take him for pressure. But again, there's really a lot of misinformation. Because I know I myself was in that camp for a long time because I was fed that misinformation. I hadn't heard the other side. And I had the wrong view on that for a long, long time. Right? But as I change my view, and as Darul Ihsan changed the view, and as many others change the view, many more can change the view as well with discussion and information, inshallah. Okay. We actually have a bit more time, so any more questions we can have. Sorry, I can't read the question.
Organ transplantation.
Yeah, what about it? Generally, for life-saving circumstances, anything's allowed almost. Again, that's a case-by-case thing. You can't really give a fatwa on that. You have to be case-by-case. And this is why I think this is something else we actually need. We need ulama who are doctors. We need that. We need someone who studies medicine and also does a bachelor's in Islamic studies. We need people like that to come up with a fiqh on these issues, because they have to, you know, generally for someone to make ijtihad in an area, they need to understand qawaid, maqasid, and usul, but they also have to understand that area. So a problem in our community is how many doctors are ulama in this community? Zero? There are a few. There are a few. But how many? Very few. Not enough. Right? We need people like that, because they are the only ones who can give us the best opinion. I'm not really qualified to give the best opinion that, because I'm not a doctor. Right? If I can sit with a doctor and I can bring the qawaid and waqas, and he can bring the medical side, and then we can come, but that'll have to be done on a case by case basis. Right? So this is why we need doctors. And in fact, we actually should have doctors who are ulama write an entire manual on this. We should have a standardized manual on this. Islamic medical practices for all doctors to follow. But again, this is work that needs to be done. This is modern day ijtihad. How can we close the doors of ijtihad? People are going to die. That's what's going to happen. So yeah, that's my best answer to that. Ladies, side, no questions there? Everyone's quiet in this time. Okay, and men's seat.
So this difficulty is worse than that, right? So the difficulty is
removed,
then
it was a
longer
relax.
So what happens in the case of traveling
in person in
travel?
Because
previously we had difficulty
traveling, now we don't have travel. We still have difficulty traveling. Have you ever traveled? Yeah. Have you ever been stuck in an airport, sitting in a queue for 10 hours, or having visa problems, or having your flight delayed? Yeah, your flight is cancelled. You have some foreign guy screaming at you in another language you understand, you know what he's angry about. Traveling is not easy. So really the issue of traveling, this, the ulama of the past considered the reduction of salah and traveling as a gift from Allah. And they say you do not reject Allah's gifts. It's a gift from Allah. So whether the travel is hard or not, Allah gave you a gift, jump on it, enjoy it. You don't make life, that one of the laws of fiqh is you don't unnecessarily make fiqh difficult on yourself. If Allah made something easy, you jump on that easy and you go with it. You don't try and find excuses to make it hard again. Right? So whether your journey is easy or hard, you stick with it. Okay, so with that we'll conclude. Next week, inshallah, we will discuss Urf. Jazakallah khairan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Quickly, how many of you have printed your notes? I don't believe so yet. Sit. How many of you have printed your notes? And we sent all of you a set of slides. We told you to download it on the website. It's all available.